Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Pitbull.
I think that education is the real revolution because as much as we speak about all the problems that there is in society and the world today, my mother's always told me, son, don't worry, the world's always been coming to an end. Don't let it scare you out of living.
Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Ariel. I moved to the U.S. at 19. I spoke no English and I struggled finding job opportunities. Everything I have, I owe to the Adult Literacy Center and getting my high school diploma at age 22.
It was an honor helping you achieve your greatness. Now you're helping others achieve theirs. It inspires me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Find free and supportive adult education centers near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
The biggest stars in country music will be taking the stage at our 2024 iHeart Country Festival, presented by Capital One.
iHeart Country.
Jason Aldean. Keith Urban. Jelly Roll. Old Dominion. Lady A. Riley Green. Ashley McBride. Brothers Osborne. Walker Hayes. All hosted by Bobby Bones at Austin's Moody Center. Saturday, May 4th. Stream only on Hulu. Starting at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific.
Welcome to Required Listening. I'm your host, Scott Goldman, Executive Director of the Grammy Museum. Each week in the Clive Davis Theater, I have the opportunity to speak with artists from across the musical spectrum about their careers, their influences, their struggles, and their creative process. Now, I'm a truly lucky guy, as are the 200 guests that get to attend our public programs at the Grammy Museum. Now, with Required Listening, I'm thrilled to share these interviews with you. On today's episode, my conversation with the band I'm With Her. The band is comprised of three accomplished musicians, Sarah Watkins, Sarah Jarosz, and Aoife O'Donovan. Each has made their mark as solo artists and as members of other bands. Sarah Jarosz is a two-time Grammy Award-winning multi-instrumentalist and singer. Aoife O'Donovan is the founder of the string band Crooked Still and has collaborated with artists from Yo-Yo Ma to Chris Thiele to the Boston Pops. Sarah Watkins is a founder of the band Nickel Creek and has maintained an active solo career, releasing three of her own albums. As fellow travelers on the acoustic and bluegrass music festival circuit, they've been around each other since they were young. In some ways, I'm With Her was bound to happen. They came together at an informal jam session during the 2014 Telluride Bluegrass Festival. Struck by the seamless and exciting sound of the music they made, they resolved to get together and work on writing songs. Two intense songwriting sessions led to recording at Peter Gabriel's Real World Studios in England with producer Ethan Johns. The resulting album, See You Around, was completed in January 2016, but because of each member's individual commitments, the album didn't come out until early 2018. But it was well worth the wait. We discussed their unique intention to subvert the individual in favor of the group. In fact, I still have trouble consistently identifying who's singing lead, and I will tell you, they love that. I think you'll get a sense of how committed they are to being a band. Their collaborative musicianship is flawless, as are the blend of their voices. We talked about the welcoming and collaborative nature of the musical community that they grew up in, and how that community helped them develop their own artistry in the process. We got together on a recent afternoon in the Clive Davis Theater exclusively for Required Listening. So let's listen to my conversation with I'm With Her. Thank you all for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So first of all, I know you've completed an East Coast leg of this tour behind the album. So how's it going?
It's going so well. Yeah. We're having a blast. It was kind of East Coast, Midwest, all the way down to Tennessee.
Uh-huh. Did you hit any of those like 10,000 nor'easters that went through the Northeast? All that snow?
No, thankfully.
Whatever, yeah.
Which was a blessing. But yeah. It's been a blast. And we had a couple weeks off, and now we're here on the West Coast. And just, it's so fun to like finally play these songs for people.
Yeah. And I want to talk about that because, you know, this is an interesting construction, this band, because you all have, you know, kind of built out solo careers and you recorded this record 2 years ago. But before we get there, I want to talk about kind of how you met, because there's, it's almost as if this was bound to happen in some way. And there's this whole community, you know, whether it's the old Settlers Festival or Rocky Grass or Telluride, where you guys were kind of in each other's orbit for a period of time. What is it about, respectively, the music that you make individually that attracted you to each other? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I think it's, we all are lucky to be a part of a sort of large and rich musical community of multi-generational, really, kind of growing up listening to music that we love and then getting to eventually make music with the people we grew up listening to. I think that's sort of been a common theme for all of us. I met Sarah in 2001 at the Philadelphia Folk Festival, Sarah Watkins. I had, you know, Nickel Creek had put out, I think, only one record at that point. And it was before This Side came out. And I remember watching her sing and just being pretty starstruck, honestly. You guys were headlining on the Friday night at the main stage, and I was playing with a band called The Wayfaring Strangers. It was really my first, the first gig I ever did at a folk festival, and we met
that
weekend.
That's so crazy to me. First folk festival thing.
And I think you mentioned Old Settlers. That's where Watkins and Giroux met that same year, I think, in 2001. And Giroux and I met then 5 years later at the Rocky Grass Festival. And it's just, I think, just speaks to the fact that our scene is so open and you know, oftentimes people will be backstage who may not necessarily be headlining the festival or maybe in a newer band or may just be a guest of somebody else backstage, and there are jams, there are people making music with each other, and that's, it's still like that. And it just feels really lucky that, I don't know, that we all met in such an informal context, and then fast forward, you know, 15 years and we're here at the Grammy Museum.
Yeah.
Yeah, in hindsight, it does feel like it was just bound to happen at some point, because it has become quite a natural fit. We all just, you know, we live well together and we travel well together, and we love to, you know, write and work together. And I think it, part of sharing that similar scenes and background is, you know, we have a similar way of communicating and pretty... like our standards, what we want a song to be like. One of my favorite things about writing in this band is that everyone really wants to make sure that, you know, we skip over some of the, maybe the first or second choices that might seem obvious or satisfying in some way, but not necessarily how we all kind of want to get a song out. It's hard to describe, but it all makes for good working relationships.
Yeah. And I want to go into the songwriting a little bit, but I want to step back just for a minute, maybe for those listening who aren't necessarily familiar with that collaborative culture in the music scene that each of you grew up in. You know, particularly at festivals, there are things that go on amongst those playing at the festivals in terms of after hours jams and people being invited to play with other artists. Talk about that a little bit in terms of your growth as a musician.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because we were talking about how, yes, there's so many things that it makes it seem like this band was destined to be a band for a long time, but at the same time, you could look at it in the other way, where like I was 9 years old when I met Sarah Watkins, and if you'd have told me then that we were going to be in a band together someday, I would have told you that you were crazy, you know. so like it's cool to like think that far back, and the context of that is exactly what you're saying. It was just a workshop at the Old Settlers Music Festival outside of Austin, Texas, which is where I'm from. Just, you know, there's kind of these extracurricular things that happen at festivals where, in addition to being able to watch a band do a main stage set, you also might get to see them do a workshop earlier on in the day, which was what happened that day. I think you guys just kind of, it wasn't even necessarily a workshop. It was like a smaller performance on a smaller stage before your main stage show that night. And so because of that, it was in a tent. I was able to like go up to them afterwards and say hello and try to get a signature, which is so cool. It, like, just the access to musicians, especially as a younger musician, it's just something that you see happen a lot, and it's encouraged, and it allows for the music and the tradition to kind of be passed along and shared.
And that is an important part of that, is passing along the tradition. There's a repertoire, you know, large though it may be, but there is a repertoire that is shared among. Is that a place where you guys met musically, in that sort of shared repertoire?
Yeah, we were at Telluride, and we were going to share the stage and do a workshop together with a couple other great musicians. The three of us were able to get together and just work up harmonies on a few songs, and we found a song or two that was common that we would, you know, could easily find a three-part harmony stack on, and so there that does ease the speed of sort of collaboration and communication. But I want to just say though that, like, the festivals and that kind of overlaps with camps to me, because I got to go to fiddle camp, Mark O'Connor's fiddle camp, when I was, I think, 13 and 14. It was his first two camps in Nashville. And I met so many people who I still know who are people who are really, really good friends. And I met them there at that camp, and I would see them at festivals. So that you see them, you get to spend this week. I got to spend this week with these terrific teachers and players of all ages and all ability ranges and styles. And then the next summer, we'd go to, you know, a handful of festivals, and I'd see kids that I knew from this fiddle camp, and we could play tunes that we had learned at camp, or we could, like, find each other in the campground for those after-hours jams that you were talking about. And so it just feels like it's very fluid and natural, the progression from hanging out with your friends to jamming in a parking lot to, like, being in a band and getting to play the kids stage. And then all of a sudden someone gives you a leg up and is like, hey, why don't you play for 15 minutes on the main stage? And, like, that happened to me too. I feel like that's a really beautiful story that a lot of people can tell. And I'm so glad that it's, you know, pretty common tale.
And it really, you know, if you look at the, you know, kind of the modern music business. The modern music business is not necessarily set up to encourage career development in many respects.
I think you're totally right. But because it's bluegrass, there's not a much business involved. Something people are going into to be lucrative.
Yeah.
It's a hobbyist's life.
Yeah, but there is that interest and that willingness and that energy to bring people along, you know, people who want to participate, to give them the chance to go to camp, to give them a chance to play on a kid's stage, to give them a chance to play on the main stage. It's a very nice system, for lack of a better term.
I think if you go back and look at the broader genre that this is, it is folk music, and folk music is music of the people. And I think it's always been like that it's always been encouraging of the younger generation, and as Sarah said, a hobbyist's genre. I mean, that's not off base. I mean, a lot of people get into playing folk music as for fun on the side. Mm. Especially when I started playing bluegrass and old time music, it was in Boston at the Cantab Lounge, this legendary dive bar in Cambridge. And I remember most of the guys who were up there on Tuesday nights. This is before Oh Brother Where Art Thou came out, so really before, you know, a ton of people were playing bluegrass sort of on the bigger stages that everybody knew about. And all the guys up on stage at the Cantab were, you know, they worked at MIT and they worked at Harvard, or they were electricians or whatever, and they were playing bluegrass. They were badasses, and they were just jamming every Tuesday night. And that was, I don't know, I think that there's something to be said for that as well.
You look out of the audience at a festival such as Rocky Grass, for instance, and I bet you 85% of the audience have guitars and sing songs with their friends. Like 85, they're relating to the bands on stage as people who speak the same language. And I think that, you know, when it's that commonality and that appreciation, the way that, like, you know, someone who you know, might build a little something in their garage, you know, or like tinkering with something, they might appreciate, you know, the workmanship of all different levels in a unique way, an insider's way. And I think that that's something that you see a lot at folk festivals.
When you guys got together
at Telluride. I think this was 2014. And you got invited, I think it was Chris maybe invited you guys to do some songs. And you were saying that you got together and found some songs that you could put together a harmony stack on. It's, you know, it just sounds so simple. Was it that simple?
Kind of. I mean, not to sort of make it seem less cool than it was, but what was really magical, I think, was not the putting together the harmony stack, but was how naturally it felt to sing the songs and how naturally the blend felt to us. I think that was sort of the wow moment. Mm. Not like, oh, let's all try to, you know, find a part here, because that's something that we're all used to doing. It was sort of the magic of the sound of the three voices together to me.
And it seems like, you know, but just based on video that, you know, that I've watched, did you immediately gravitate to that one microphone and you're all singing around it? Was that something you went to, like,
we don't do that all the time
instinctively?
Yeah, I think that's something that is a great way to get this music across. Mm. It's a good way to do that. And a lot of times it's easier for us to make sure that we're blending and mixing the way that we want to if we just do it ourselves on stage. Mm. Around one microphone.
Yeah.
So there's a simplicity to it, kind of, and also it's really great to play with each other that well, like facing each other that close together. Mm. I think everyone's a very common scenario that you're like, you're running songs backstage in the dressing room and you're facing each other and you're really close together. It sounds great. And then you get on stage and it's like not, it's kind of wobbly and you just don't have the pocket that you had because you're, you know, spread out in a straight mm-hmm. line and you can't quite hear as well as you did. And there's a great pleasure to me of just singing around that one mic and getting to really focus on the sound and just kind of, I am able to get into a different kind of focus zone that way.
Well, you know, it strikes me from watching, and this is just, you know, sort of an observation, that you're playing as much for each other as you are for people in the audience. Is that how it feels to you guys?
Yeah, I would say so. And I think it was important. You know, we were really playing around the one mic mostly for the first couple of years as this band. Mm. And I feel like it, as Sarah was saying, it was like sonically unifying to kind of, as a young band, be able to be that close and figure out what our blend is, what our vibe is, how the different timbres of our voices go together. Mm. Instead of like just right away going to a multi-mic setup, I think now I personally feel more comfortable on a multi-mic setup, having had the time put in with the one mic. Yeah. And I still think it's nice to go back to the one mic too, because it's so special and intimate and close that way. But I think it's important to our sound, certainly.
Yeah. If you guys ever come back and do a performance here.
That would be the way to do it here.
The one mic thing.
Yeah.
We've only had one artist do that here.
Really?
Yeah, and it sounded...
So bizarre. It's very surprising. That's the only one. Yeah, who was it?
Tiff Merritt.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Hi there. I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is when they start to write a record, they're like, oh, that's not the line. Oh, that's not this. Oh, it's not that. And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's take a moment to breathe. Deep inhale. Extend your spine. Remain focused on what you're doing. If safe to do so, exhale slowly, leaning to one side. Inhale back to center. If safe to do so, exhale slowly to the opposite side. Find mental health resources at loveyourmindtoday.org. This message is brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ed Council.
The biggest stars in country music will be taking the stage at our 2024 iHeart Country Festival, presented by Capital One.
iHeart Country.
Jason Aldean. Keith Urban. Jelly Roll. Old Dominion. Lady A. Riley Green. Ashley McBride. Brothers Osborne. Walker Hayes. All hosted by Bobby Bones at Austin's Moody Center. Saturday, May 4th. Stream only on Hulu. Starting at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific.
I want to talk about, you know, kind of shared influences just for a minute. And we talked about festivals and that kind of stuff. But I've read some things that you guys have discussed amongst yourselves, albums that you have shared a love for over time. And I'm wondering if there's a couple maybe that you could tell me that stand out for you that you guys have all said, oh, wait a minute, I love that record.
Well, I feel like one thing we've talked about is like the Tim and Molly O'Brien, just in terms of like great harmony singing. Mm-hmm. I feel like A Way Out on the Mountain, just such great song selections and harmony singing. And that's just a record I think that we all have put time in and really loved. Mm-hmm. And then there's obviously the Vampire Weekend record.
I think that was the one I read.
Okay, Modern Weekend. Vampires of the City. Yeah. What's fun is that when we went on our first like 3-week tour in Europe in 2015, I had actually never heard that record before. And Aoife and Sarah had put in time with it. And so it was fun, but I feel like you guys hadn't heard it in a while. And so it was
new then.
Oh, it was new.
That was when it came out.
Okay, yeah. But you had already put in some time.
It came out about 8 months before that. Yeah, so
So we like blasted it in the car over the course of those 3 weeks, and it was just so fun because it was just the three of us.
I feel like it's rare these days to revisit the same album in the course of a tour very often. Like a lot of times when you're driving down the road, everyone's, you know, sharing their favorites or just taking turns DJing. And a lot of times the temptation is to just like, you know, put in a different, you know, make a playlist of different songs and different artists each time. But it's really great to put in albums. Hmm. And I feel like, I mean, that's a unique experience in the last like 10 years for me to put in the same album probably 10 times
every day, I feel like.
In one road trip, you know? And it was really good.
Is there something on the playlist right now? Some album that's being played repeatedly?
Well, this leg is just starting, so.
Oh, okay.
Sound of Music. I actually have really been listening a lot to the Sound of Music soundtrack, and it's really good. I just want to say for the record,
fair enough.
Sometimes you just have to go dig way back deep into your subliminal early influences and figure out what it is that makes you tick. Mm-hmm. And I think it's Christopher Plummer for me.
Oh, he does such a good job on that.
There's one artist that I have to ask you about because he's an all-time favorite of mine going back, and I'm old, going way back, and that's John Hartford.
Mm. I was just about to say Steam Powered Airplane is another favorite of ours.
And I was lucky enough when I was a teenager, I went to see him at a weird festival in Massachusetts and somehow got backstage and got to talk to him for a period of time.
Can I ask what festival?
You know what? I don't even remember the name. I remember it was in the town of Fitchburg, Massachusetts, which is in central Massachusetts. It was in a high school football stadium.
Wow.
And it was Hartford, and I don't even remember who else was on the bill because I was just focused on him, and they were playing off the back of a flatbed truck. That's really all I remember. And there was very, you know, back in those days, this is 1974.
I was going to say early 70s, you saw that a lot. Telluride and Merlefest both started on flatbed trucks.
And I just walked back there and he was leaning against a car or whatever. And this was after Aeroplane had come out and before he had released that Warner Brothers, the last Warner Brothers record he did. And he was going on and on with me about how there was four sides of material that he recorded and Warner Brothers would only release one record. Hmm. And he was off about that, but the genius nonetheless. So what is it about John Hartford that you guys adore?
For me, I got to spend a little bit of time with him as well. And for me, he was a gateway out of a lot of the things that I was really listening for when I was a kid. It was, you know, you're a kid, you're listening to like speed and precision. I think that's, you know, pretty typical for like high school aged kids. And then something like Hartford broke all the rules and I didn't know why I loved him so much. And I couldn't put my finger on it because he defied my typical checklist. But I feel like there's so much of his personality came out in his songwriting and in his performances in a way that you don't see a lot. You know, like you, I feel like other people who do that are, maybe like Harry Nilsson and Roger Miller, those kinds of characters who let that silliness come out in the songs. Johnny Fritz is a guy who's opening for us tonight. I think he also lets his personality come out in his songs in a similar way. But and he was also really kind to me. But I think the personality, feeling, getting an impression of who he is through his music was something that I hadn't experienced in that way. And that was the first thing I think that drew me in. And then from there, it just goes so deep that, you know, you could.
I mean, he had a vision, I think, of where he believed his music should go. And he was going to follow that regardless. Which I thought
there's
was
a confidence in that of just writing, you know, being himself truly through and through and in all the wacky, weird things. I mean, the legend is that he wrote the washing machine song the same day as he wrote Gentle on My Mind. and I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It feels like his music is like an extension of himself more than like a performance. Also, one fun fact is that the first time I met Sarah was also the first time that I saw John Hartford live at Old Cellars, and that was his. You guys played Nickel Creek played with him, and that wound up being his last
performance,
public performance. Which I just feel so thankful to have seen that, and it just felt like a very. That's also the first day I met Tim O'Brien and Daryl Scott. Like it just felt like a fortuitous day.
Wow.
So there's a track on the record. Waitsfield, I think that's your homage to Hartford.
I don't think it is.
Have we said that?
I think I might have said.
I read that somewhere.
I'm not sure an homage, but like I definitely think of him a little bit in the silliness of that tune. But it wasn't written as like a tribute to him. I just feel like there's a little bit of.
But you guys do sort of bust out at the end of that.
The performance, I think, when we recorded that song, I remember just everybody kind of holding their breath, just trying to get to the end without messing it up. And when we did, that's why there's this sort of everybody's holding their breath and then we laugh. And it's just, I think we left it on the record because that is really what happened.
I mean, and it's such a genuine
moment. Actually adds to the musical experience of listening to that track.
I think it does. I mean, there's an energy, you know, you sort of pick up the energy at the end, you know, you kind of realize what you guys were, you know, were going through as you were recording. It was cool.
And that song has been so fun to play live every night. That's sort of a moment that I look forward to in the set every night. It really does feel like a release.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great.
When we made it, we were, I think, a little bit slap happy at the time. And I feel like it was pretty late in the process of making the record. And I also think it was late at night or after dinner or maybe just before dinner or something. And I think by that point I was just trying to remember the arrangement.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but there is something about it that just like, I just kept like getting like distracted or lost or something. And so I was particularly delighted to just make it through that song. And I think what you hear on the album is the first time we actually did finish it. It was like the third attempt, first succeed, success.
I want to talk about songwriting for a minute. I'm wondering, you know, particularly for this record, were these songs that each of you individually were kind of bringing to the group, or was it a shared songwriting experience? How did the songwriting work?
Well, it kind of happened in two chunks of writing sessions. One here in LA in the summer, July of 2015, and then another 8-day writing session in Vermont at a farmhouse in rural Vermont in December of 2015. And something that we've kind of talked about that I think was so important to the writing process was the fact that we were living together. for both of those stints. We were in the same, well, I guess when we were in Los Angeles, we were, Aoife and I were in an Airbnb. Sarah lives here, but we were basically all at the Airbnb the entire time. And, you know, making lunch together and kind of living our days together, which I think was so important to the stories of these songs feeling shared, even if, you know, there definitely were moments when, you know, someone would bring in a verse and a chorus or a start of an idea to a song. But because we're living together for these two writing stints, just the nature of talking through the stories and kind of having to explain yourself a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think that was something that was so enlightening about this writing process for me, is that I feel like I've written by myself so much that, you know, when you write a song by yourself, an idea that makes sense to you or a line that makes total sense to you might not actually make sense to someone else. And just by having these conversations of, oh, but what is that line? What are you trying to say? And then that turns into a conversation, and then the conversation turns back into the song. I think that that whole process of being together for several days in a row allowed these stories to feel like, for all of us to have ownership over them and feel like a shared thing.
How did you guys both, you know, sort of all jump in on that sort of feedback loop? Was that
how? Yeah, definitely. What do you mean? Like, with ideas?
just in terms of bringing ideas and then you know, kind of not challenging, but refining.
Yes, but that, and in addition to that process of everybody bringing ideas and refining, there were also a couple of instances where we really did just start songs from scratch in the same room as each other. Where, yeah. I mean, of course, yes, an idea can't spontaneously spring out of three people's brains at once. Somebody would start with a groove, and then we would sort of, you know, I remember writing Game to Lose was one that came out like that. I think the verses for that song, I remember sitting in the room in Vermont and just sort of, I don't even remember who started playing a groove, and then we were just kind of like, like, and then we kind of went from there, and it really just naturally, like, just the ideas kept on snowballing, and then they were refined after that. So for processes such as that one, or
also I-89,
yeah, where the idea would get started with the three of us, and then kind of back up, and you'd kind of go back to the place of like, okay, even though we all brought this idea, we can still all challenge it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
That's how I remember it.
Do you still look at an album as a body of work?
Definitely.
Because, you know, that too has been challenged in the modern sort of music.
Yeah,
world.
But thinking about it though, and like, I think we do all think of an album as, mm-hmm. as its own thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like, it's not the first time that people have been listening to one song at a time, right? Like, that's kind of how things started.
True.
One, people put out an A side and a B side, you know, mm-hmm. and it was singles was how it started. Mm-hmm. Why there's a record of the year and it's a song. So it kind of is just going back to how it started, where people were listening to one song at a time from a band. But I think that you will always find that a good amount of recording artists will want to see that full picture as mm-hmm. as a standalone piece or as like a thought, you know.
Is there a thematic thread? Is there something that ties the songs together?
Travel has been a theme that people have sort of latched onto when we've talked to people about the record. I don't think we went into it saying let's write an album with this theme in mind, but listening back, I do get a sense of the narrator or whoever the protagonist or whoever is singing these songs is a traveler, and we are all travelers.
I feel like there's one of the things that comes out of living in this like shared space for those two writing stints is that the songs did come from a time and place. And so I think that their common threads are, you know, what we were all bringing to the table as, you know, our concerns or our stories or what we'd been thinking through. That for those, like that week that we were together, that's what is on the album. So it makes sense that there is a common thread, though I don't know what it would be. I feel like it's just what life was that week.
Yeah.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is when they start to write a record, they're like, oh, that's not the line. Oh, that's not this. Oh, it's not that. And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Check the backseat. Check the backseat.
All right, come here.
Check the backseat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the backseat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
The biggest stars in country music will be taking the stage at our 2024 iHeart Country Festival, presented by Capital One.
iHeart Country.
Jason Aldean. Keith Urban. Jelly Roll. Old Dominion. Lady A. Riley Green. Ashley McBride. Brothers Osborne. Walker Hayes. All hosted by Bobby Bones at Austin's Moody Center. Saturday, May 4th. Stream only on Hulu. Starting at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific.
You went away to record this record. Far away, in fact, to, you know, to the UK. Was that isolation helpful? I mean, you're long way from home, long way, you know, potentially from friends and family, though you may have friends over there. Did that help in getting this done?
I think so. Yeah, I think it was pretty necessary because of all of our crazy schedules. I mean, the fact that we were able to squeeze in making the record in 3 weeks at a crazy time. We were all about to release our own solo records. Aoife released her record in the Magic Hour the day that we flew away from the studio.
You were mixing your record.
Yeah, I was still mixing my record, Undercurrent.
Which won 2 Grammys.
And Watkins was in the process of release. Ours came out a month apart from each other. So it was wild. And I think because all of that was sort of, you know, building, we were kind of getting in the headspace of going on tour and doing these record release things. I think it was really important to just get away from any of our individual domains and just be removed and be really focused for an intense focus for 3 weeks. I mean, we ate every meal together with Ethan.
It was intense.
It was really intense.
I hear you got tired of the soup.
Yeah.
Is that
true? Would really think that we would have gotten tired of each other, but miraculously we would end up in this little common room that had like 3 couches and we would all sit on like one half of one couch, literally
during our free time.
And I think other people who were there like must have thought we were actually insane because we would be together all day. And then like afterwards, Sarah Watkins would make a fire in the fireplace because that's just how boss she is. And we would sit on half of a couch and just like be silly. It's quite incredible.
You guys work with Ethan Johns.
Yeah.
Why him? Why choose him as the producer?
Well, you're talking about common music and I think on that, I feel like his name came up when we were first on that tour in the UK, that 3-week tour that we were driving around. Or maybe we were driving around somewhere else, but we were talking about like if we made an album, who would we make it with? Who would we, you know? And his name came up as someone who whose work we'd all, you know, really enjoyed, and I'd worked with him years before, and so we eventually, you know, we kept talking about it and thinking about it and finally reached out and he was interested. Jerose and Aoife didn't actually meet him until we got to the studio. We FaceTimed him from Vermont 3 weeks before we started the record. But like that was that was it. So it was, I think that added to the intensity of it because, you know, you're flying all the way to London and then driving to Box, which is outside of Bath, and you're there living and eating and recording there for 3 weeks. And it's just kind of an intense commitment when you haven't met someone. Mm-hmm. And so we, you know, we arrived and then, you know, saw the most intimate recording setup. I think, you know, we'd worked in before and just kind of started it off. And, I feel like because of the intensely intimate way that we recorded with no headphones, no separation at all, we were, as close as we are when we stand together backstage rehearsing. And he and the Ethan and the engineer, Dominic Monks, were right like 10 feet away in the same room, no separation at all. So they were just listening to us perform in front of the mics without the monitors or anything on. Maybe I think the engineer had headphones, but like it was just, everyone was just very focused on the performance and listening to each other and the moment. And Ethan has a reputation for being like a first take producer, and we definitely experienced that and definitely pushed for sometimes like a second and third performance because these songs we'd written 3 weeks before, we didn't have any experience performing them. So I think we fought for that a little bit early on and then hit our stride. And I feel like they got great sounds.
Yeah. I mean, the record sounds terrific. But, you know, that producer-artist relationship is oftentimes key to the sound of a record, to, you know, maybe the way the songs are constructed, whatever it might be. You know, the producer can shape songs or sonics, sometimes be the psychologist and right. sort of hold the mirror up and
totally.
Say...
Totally. Band therapy.
Yeah. You know, this is what you're doing. How did he work with you? What was so good about working with him?
Well, I mean, I think it kind of was the pushing us to kind of expose the rawness of what we have. And I think, I mean, maybe the main reason that I was so interested in wanting to work with him was his ability to capture dynamics on a recording, which I just feel is something that I don't hear much anymore on records. It's like a wall of sound, and many records to me these days just sound very horizontal. And that's something that I've loved about.
So when you say dynamics, you mean like, you know, loud, soft,
yes,
you know,
yes, the, getting like really soft and then exploding, you know. I just think, and you know, and a lot of that has to do with Dominic Monks as well. But I think it's a combination of kind of, like you said, the psychology of it, kind of forcing it to be this very intimate, intense thing where there's no isolation, as Sarah was saying, and you know that was his doing. You know, I think had we not walked into the room and it was set up like that, like who knows what it would have been like. So I think that was, that's kind of his strength, is creating that environment where everything is just really bare and honest.
Cause I did read something that when you first walked into the studio, there was a fair amount of trepidation about the way it was set up.
Yeah, I think I had never been in a recording studio without the luxury of my own zone, you know, my own headphone mix and my own, you know, just space to like, it's okay if I mess up once because I can always just go ahead and fix that if it's an otherwise perfect take. Mm-hmm. And I think because we had written the music so close to the recording session, we had come out of the Vermont writing session, I think on December 12th or 13th, or it was very, very close to when we went to the UK January 2nd. So it's not like we'd been playing these songs for a year and we knew them very well. So it was a little bit scary. But that being said, what we got out of that recording session, I think, is an album that I mean, we were talking earlier about John Hartford as an extension of himself and the music that he makes. And I feel like we were almost not forced into doing that, but it definitely helped us and encouraged us to be more ourselves. And I think that when you listen to the album, that's what I think what you hear is the three of us and our band, I'm With Her, and not just sort of like another thing with all the bells and whistles.
Mm. And you know, one of the things that struck me, particularly listening, you know, listening to the songs and then subsequently reading a little bit, I was never, I don't think to this day, I'm exactly sure who's singing what. and I think that that's quite intentional on your part, that you, and don't take this the wrong way, that you subverted the individual for the group. Am I right in that?
I think so. Yeah.
I would take that as a compliment, honestly.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
That's we're a band. We're not mm-hmm. doing this project calling it, you know, Sarah Walken, Sarah Droz, and Aoife mm-hmm. O'Donovan. I mean, mm-hmm. we're a band. We think of ourselves as a band. I'm not waiting for my turn to get up and sing my song or mm-hmm. going to pat myself on the back for, you know, anything that I'm doing on stage. I feel like we're all thinking of it as a trio, our project.
Right. Because as you know, as I listen to the songs, I do not feel that I'm listening, who's ever singing lead, that I'm listening to that person's story. That's yes. not kind of where it resonates for me.
I think it was right on with our experience too. Yeah.
The
I love that's your
yeah.
take.
Yeah,
on
yeah,
it.
Yeah. No, I mean, great. Seriously, I couldn't. I you know, could be me. I don't know. The other thing, and we touched on this when we started, is these songs were recorded in 2016. And then you guys go off and have, you know, you all released records and you're doing other things. And here you are now, it's 2018, and now you're touring. And I'm wondering, as you got back together, have the songs changed? Have they evolved in some way?
I don't. Not much. I mean, I think that they might begin to as we kind of go further into this year of actually being on the road playing them. But I really feel like in order for, because we knew the reality of our schedules, we knew that in order to make this work as a band, because we were all committed, we did have to kind of put it to the side for a hot second, which wound up being 2 years. and, you know, I think because we realized when we flew away from England, we kind of all agreed to say, okay, we're gonna kind of just gonna pretend that doesn't exist. I think for the sake of freshness, for the sake of it being realizing the, you know, what the schedule is going to be like. So I think we all did a really good job of doing that. And it's been fun this year, kind of, I guess we started in January with a couple of shows, but you know, the last tour that we went on in, end of February into March was really the first time we were playing many of these songs, some of them the very first time in front of audiences. And so I think they are at this point still pretty close to how they sound on the record, but I think that's one of the fun things about performing live is that it is fun when songs kind of do start to take on a new life for the stage as opposed to in the studio.
Is that something that you've experienced in your solo careers, that songs that you have come to play and know, you know, kind of intimately over the years do take on sort of a different?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I sometimes after being on tour for a year playing the songs from my record in the Magic Hour, it'll be on, somebody will put the record on and I'll be like, what song is this? Like, I don't do it the same way at all. Like, I don't know if you guys have had that experience, but.
Yeah, do you forget kind of the original version
yeah.
of it?
Yeah.
I have, the arrangements haven't changed yet that much, but even, you know, we were in Atlanta, a friend was in the audience who had just had a baby, and we got to say hi before the show, and there were a couple of songs that I was singing with sort of his current life status in mind, and some of the lyrics took on new meaning because of that, which I really like.
Mm-hmm. You closed the record with a Gillian Welch tune, 100 Miles. Of the many songs you could have chosen to cover, why that one?
We actually do cover a lot of songs. Mm-hmm. Before we made this record, before we started writing it, we had like 2 hours of cover songs. We were a cover band. And then we would also do a few songs from our own material, but I think the reason we chose that to record was, well, one of the reasons is, you know, we are all huge admirers of her mm-hmm. songwriting, as is the world. And it was kind of cool to have learned this one that she hadn't recorded. I came across, you know, a handful of songs that she hadn't recorded. And that one was really just stood out. And so we'd played it live a little bit on the before, you know, on tours, but the version that you hear on the album was is totally different than how we were performing it. We tried to record it the way we had been playing it. We thought it would be an easy one because we actually knew it, and it just didn't fit the album. So we came back to it at the end of the process, and I think it was the last song that we recorded. And we tried to play it. It just wasn't working. And I think Aoife was like, can we just do it a cappella? Like, just see how it goes. And Ethan went over and played some pump organ. And we might have just barely mapped it out. Like, you start it, you come in. I think I'll come in on the chorus and, you know, we'll... And we played it down. And that's the version that you hear on the album. Mm. And it's... I think we just needed... Having gone through that intense 3 weeks recording process, that was just the way that it seemed to fit the rest of the songs, and it seemed to suit us, like kind of the new us that had gone through this recording process and tightened up as a band. You know, I think in terms of our vision for the band and also our playing, it seemed to fit us better when we came through that.
I mean, it really strikes me listening to the three of you talk about the process from beginning to write to going to England to record the record to now, that there's been a real evolution amongst the three of you as a band, that you've kind of come to understand kind of who you are as a band. And am I right in that?
I think it's, yeah. And I think it's, you know, constantly evolving as we embark on this tour, which we just had a planning meeting, and there's lots more to come. And we're also excited about, I don't know, taking these songs to as many places as we can possibly go with them, and then you seeing what's next after that. You know, yeah. I think we'll all continue to make albums under our own name and continue to collaborate in the ways that we always have. And this is just—it's just such a blast being in this band. Mm-hmm. I think for all three of us.
Well, all I can tell you is it's a blast having you here at the Grammy Museum in R&R Podcast Required Listening. I'm with her, Sarah. Aoife, Sarah, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I personally love discussing John Hartford with the band. Their reverence for his work, his fearless and eclectic approach, really helped me understand I'm With Her on a musical level. Check out Hartford's groundbreaking 1971 release, Aeroplane. Long before Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, John Hartford recorded an album with bluegrass greats Norman Blake on guitar, Tut Taylor on dobro, Vassar Clements on fiddle, Randy Scruggs on bass, and Hartford playing guitar and banjo. The music is joyous, irreverent, and top-notch musicianship is everywhere. Check out tracks like Turn Your Radio On or Up on the Hill Where They Do the Boogie, and you'll instantly get Hartford's unique musical sensibility. Then go back to I'm With Her and listen to the energy and musicianship on the track Waitsfield. I'm With Her's new album is called See You Around. And that's your required listening for today. Let me know what you think of John Hartford and I'm With Her. We're on all the socials at Grammy Museum. If you're planning a visit to Los Angeles, I hope you'll come see us. All the info is at our website, GrammyMuseum.org. As always, my thanks to the team that makes required listening happen. Jason James, Justin Joseph, Jim Canella, Lynn Sheridan, Miranda Moore, Callie Weissman, Len Brown, Mike Werbacher, Jason Hoke, Chandler Mays, Nick Stumpf, and the entire team at How Stuff Works. For Required Listening, I'm Scott Goldman. We'll see you next time.
Hi there. I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing.
This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Pitbull.
I think that education is the real revolution, because as much as we speak about all the problems that there is in society and the world today, my mother's always told me, son, don't worry, the world's always been coming to an end. Don't let it scare you out of living.
Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Ariel. I moved to the U.S. at 19. I spoke no English and I struggled finding job opportunities. Everything I have, I owe to the Adult Literacy Center and getting my high school diploma at age 22.
It was an honor helping you achieve your greatness. Now you're helping others achieve theirs. It inspires me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Find free and supportive adult education centers near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
The biggest stars in country music will be taking the stage at our 2024 iHeart Country Festival, presented by Capital One.
iHeart Country.
Jason Aldean. Keith Urban. Jelly Roll. Old Dominion. Lady A. Riley Green. Ashley McBride. Brothers Osborne. Walker Hayes. All hosted by Bobby Bones at Austin's Moody Center. Saturday, May 4th. Stream only on Hulu. Starting at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific.